Welcome back to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. This show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. I'm Kristen Cornett, a holistic nutritionist and functional wellness practitioner at Tiny Feet.
And I'm Dr. Haley Knight, a naturopathic doctor and certified nutritionist at Synergy Women's Healthcare in Portland, Oregon. Our goal with this show is to educate and empower couples with the knowledge they need to get pregnant, stay pregnant, and have the healthiest baby possible.
If you're looking for personalized one-on-one guidance for your health or fertility struggles, you can learn more about working remotely with me, Kristen, by visiting my website at tinyfeet.co, or you can schedule a free 20-minute phone consult now through the link in the podcast episode description. If you're local to the Portland, Oregon area, you can learn more about seeing Dr. Haley in person at her clinic by visiting drhaley.com. We've also created an online course together called Fertile in 5 Masterclass, which walks you through everything you need to know to prepare for a healthy pregnancy. Visit bit.ly/fertileinfive to learn more about the course and get signed up. All right, you're listening to episode 64, and we're actually going to be trying out something new here on the podcast with this episode. Today is a question and answer session where we're going to share some of the questions we've received recently on social media via email and from our own clients and patients about a variety of preconception and fertility topics. Our goal is to share an episode like this every month or two so that our entire audience can benefit from the questions that we've been answering privately. And since we are thinking about making this a regular thing on the podcast, we would really love to hear from you about any questions you may have that we can include in future episodes. If there's something you'd really love to know, go ahead and email your question to info@tinyfeet.co or send me a DM on Instagram at tinyfeet.co. I'll respond to you within a few days with an answer, and then Dr. Haley and I will pick about 10 questions to cover on air in an upcoming episode so everyone can hear our perspectives on each topic. Don't worry, the questions that we share on the show will be anonymous. On today's episode, we'll be answering questions about detoxification, thyroid labs, folate and B vitamins, coffee while trying to conceive, supplements for men to consider during preconception, and more. We hope you enjoy the episode, and we're excited to get more questions from you going forward.
Okay, so our first question is it safe to detox while actively trying to conceive? And what do you think about saunas, dry skin brushing, and castor oil packs?
All right, so I guess I'll take the lead on this one and get started. So is it safe to detox while you're actively trying to conceive? No, it's not safe to detox while you're actively trying. This is if you're going to target detoxification or you're concerned that you might have a buildup of environmental toxins in your system or heavy metal exposure or something like that, that really needs to be something that's dealt with in a focused detoxification before you start trying. And my goal with clients is to, you know, start a detoxification program and finish that about at least one month, preferably 2 months before you're actively going to start trying. And then the question about saunas and dry skin brushing and castor oil packs, those are all amazing detoxification strategies. And because of that, those are not things that I would recommend doing while you're in that stage of actively trying. Saunas are awesome for sweating and opening up that elimination pathway through the skin, but they do push detox and they're also very high heat. We just don't really have research yet that says whether or not heat of like an infrared sauna, for instance, is safe or has any effect on egg quality. We know that heat can have an effect on sperm quality, so it's something I typically recommend avoiding in the 2 to 3 months before actively trying for women as well as for men. And then in terms of dry brushing is great because it stimulates lymphatic flow in the body. So like your circulatory system, which pumps blood throughout your body, that has a pump. It has your heart. But your lymphatic system, which actually moves more fluid than your circulatory system, doesn't have a pump and it relies on movement to stimulate it. And so with dry brushing toward the heart, you know, from the extremities toward the heart, it actually stimulates lymphatic flow and that can help stimulate detoxification. So dry brushing is awesome, but it's another thing that I would pair with a detoxification protocol before you start trying. And same thing with castor oil packs. That stimulates liver function, which is awesome, but if you have a lot to detoxify, you don't want to be doing that when you're in that stage, when you're in preconception or if you happen to possibly be getting pregnant that cycle, I wouldn't recommend doing castor oil packs.
Okay. Very interesting that we obviously didn't talk about these questions together before we started recording. But I agree with Kristen definitely on like active detoxification, more active cleanses where you're taking supplements, and that's meaning to push detox. As far as I disagree a little bit, not that I disagree, but I follow kind of a different tactic when it comes to these more gentle detoxes, such as dry skin brushing and castor oil packs. I think those are fine to use, in my personal opinion, when somebody's trying to conceive. I have some more medical information on castor oil packs, and they have been shown to be quite gentle. The only thing with castor oil packs is that, and to give a little bit more background so you guys understand like what this is basically at any health food store, you should be able to find castor oil, usually in like the pharmacy section. And you would put it on a wool cloth, or you can even put it on a t-shirt, and you would just lay it over your belly or over your liver. And you can put plastic over it and then put a heating pad over it, and it's supposed to help with detoxification. Now, if you're actively trying to conceive, then I would not put it over your uterus. And so some women are using it for cramps. They really like that it helps during that menstrual period. Obviously, if you're having your menses, then you're not pregnant. So I think it's fine to go ahead and use a castor oil pack at that time, even if you are trying to conceive. But if you are in that luteal phase and there is any type of chance that you might have conceived that particular month, then I would say put it up higher near your liver, and then just use really low heat. But the castor oil packs actually have been shown to be quite safe, and you can use them in pregnancy as well. This dry skin brushing, again, that's just moving your lymph around, which is something everybody should be doing. It's similar to exercise. So when you're contracting your muscles, such as running or swimming, then it's also moving your lymph around. And so dry skin brushing can just give your lymph a little bit of extra movement to be able to gently detox. I agree with Kristen on saunas. I think that, you know, the heat, especially with men, that it has been shown that it can decrease motility and increase where morphology is off with the sperm. With women, of course, there's no research on that whatsoever. So I think if you're actively trying to conceive, you might want to just avoid the saunas, or just do it maybe when you know that you're not pregnant. So just in that, during your menses, or just that first week after menses. So
yeah, with the castor oil packs and the dry skin brushing, that's one that I wouldn't recommend like stopping 3 or 4 months before, like not like saunas. So I wouldn't put those in the same category as saunas. Those are just things I would recommend avoiding like in a 2 week wait, but if you want to continue using castor oil packs, it sounds like we don't have evidence to suggest that it's unsafe. I think if there's like an acute toxic exposure, like if you're targeting something like heavy metals, or you know that detoxification is like a major area of focus, I guess I would just be concerned about what you might set out circulating like right during that period that conception could take place. So, I mean, the reality is that I don't think that we have super great evidence on any of these strategies. This is more just like, what can we say may or may not be safe during this period? So,
yeah. And, you know, for me, I'm just using the little bit of research that we do have, the traditional medicine guides that have talked about castor oil in the past and dry skin brushing. And then, of course, just like Kristen was saying, is that if you're going through an active cleanse, like often that we would prescribe for my patients or for Kristen's clients, then, and we're also doing the skin brushing and the saunas and the castor oil packs, that's the time that you don't want to be actively conceiving, because she's right. And, you know, we're moving a lot of gunk around the bloodstream, and it's just a time where it could mess with like the epigenetics of that conception, and maybe inhibiting, you know, the proper nutrients to be there with that conception. And so it's just something that we want to avoid and get through that process and then try to conceive at a later date.
So at the end of the day, we don't really disagree.
No.
That's okay. We can have an adult practitioner discussion. And, you know, I think it's valuable when not everybody has exactly the same opinion on everything. So this will be interesting.
Exactly.
This is true. Yeah. Dr. Haley and I did not discuss our answers about these questions beforehand. So this should be fun for the rest of the episode. All right. So next question is about thyroid, and it's about a marker that really doesn't get a lot of play in the thyroid discussion. So the question is, what is the significance of reverse T3 on a thyroid panel, and should I push for my doctor to include it?
Okay, so reverse T3 is a hormone of just like what it sounds like. So there's active T4, there's active T3, which are the hormones that the thyroid's secreting. And then there's reverse T3. So what we've seen in the research is that typically reverse T3 will go up when there's an increase in cortisol levels. So chronic stress can increase in reverse T3. And then also chronic illness or chronic inflammation. Something is going on that we need to discover more about, right? And treat. So what happens is when stress increases, cortisol goes up, and then cortisol inhibits T4 and the conversion of T4 to T3. And instead of it converting into active T3, which we want, it converts it into the reverse T3. So in my opinion, is that what I do with my patients is that if they're obviously struggling with energy, if they have chronic symptoms like hair loss, depression, anxiety, then I'll definitely add the reverse T3 onto that thyroid panel. Sometimes I could do a thyroid panel, and if everything's normal but the T3 is really low, which happens often, then that just is another indicator that there's high cortisol and probably a high reverse T3. So in that case, I'll order a reverse T3. Now, if they seem pretty well, they have good energy, they're reporting that they're sleeping well, then I'll usually just screen the thyroid and not order the reverse T3.
So I agree with this approach exactly. And yeah,
maybe I agree.
No, this is exactly what I typically do. Although, like, I have a custom blood panel that I order that does include the reverse T3. And, you know, a lot of the people that are coming to see me are specifically trying to investigate something like recurrent miscarriage or unexplained infertility. And in those cases, and a lot of them have chronic health symptoms as well. And so I will typically just leave it on the custom panel rather than remove it. But there are other times where I will see blood work that was ordered by another practitioner, and I'll see, okay, we have that low free T3 and we don't have the reverse T3 information. And I suspect that this might be at play for this particular person. And so I may order it on a follow-up panel, but yeah, the indications for sure, chronic stress or some type of inflammation or chronic illness, something that's stressing the body. And, you know, there's the theory that reverse T3 is kind of the way that your body is trying to get you to slow down so that you can heal. And so converting into an inactive T3 hormone and reducing that active free T3 that you need to stimulate and keep your metabolism up and healthy and also support reproductive health, that it's kind of the body's innate intelligence telling us we need to slow that metabolism down. We need to slow the person down so that they can chill out and heal.
Yeah, reverse T3 will actually be higher with people with acute illness, like you have the flu, or if you have, you know, just a really horrible cold, reverse T3 will go up. So it's definitely one of those signals that is telling the body to slow down. However, if it's chronically elevated, that's not good for anybody.
No, it's definitely not. And we'll often see this marker elevated in very, very ill patients, very ill elderly patients, which is obviously not as relevant to this particular audience. But yeah, it is a sign that something has gone terribly awry in the body if it's really elevated over long periods of time.
So to go back to the question, as far as like, should I push my doctor to include it? I would say if your thyroid panel came back and you did see a low T3, like a normal T4, but your T3 was borderline low. So maybe not even off the reference range, but borderline low or really low, then that might be enough information to say like, okay, your cortisol levels are high. You might want to like your next step might want, you might want to test a cortisol awakening response or some type of cortisol curve and just kind of see what's happening with your cortisol. However, and if you're like, no, I really want to know that reverse T3 is high, then that would be a good next step too.
Yeah. And then I guess that, that kind of begs the next question, which was not part of the question, but might be helpful for us to talk about, which is what is technically considered an elevated reverse T3?
What is considered elevated? Well, I usually look, I'm always looking at the functional numbers. And so if there is, if it's borderline high or obviously if it's elevated. So, you know, if a lot, I think we've talked about this before, Kristen, is like the way that they figure out these lab reference ranges is they just take what they seemingly think are healthy people and they just take a whole bunch of them and then they make these lab reference numbers, but they don't really, I guess, filter out people who are possibly dealing with some type of chronic illness that maybe hasn't been diagnosed yet or so.
Which is often true for people that are going to get blood work done.
Right.
Which I think is really interesting. So in terms of what the, like, I'll just give you an example from like LabCorp blood work. So I'm pulling one up here right now because I don't have the conventional reference range right off the top of my head. But a reverse T3 reference range, I think it's like well in the 20s of what's considered elevated. So they consider it conventionally, the LabCorp reference range is 9.2 to 24.1. And that's very similar to what I would look at for the functional range, actually. So reverse T3 functional range would be like somewhere in that like 10 to 15 range on the low end and somewhere between like 25, 26 on the upper end of the range. So if it's above that, or if it's creeping toward the top end of that range and you also see that that free T3 is functionally low, then that could be an indicator. And so whether or not you should push your doctor to include it, if you're investigating potential chronic health issues, you're investigating an issue with your fertility, I'd say it's worth having. It is a more expensive marker, so if insurance decides not to cover it, that could unfortunately lead to a higher out-of-pocket expense. So it's worth having if you can get it, but if your doctor's like, ugh, you don't need this, and you're not struggling with anything in particular, you're just wanting to get a little bit more information on your thyroid function, might be okay to leave it out.
Yeah. All right.
All right, next Let's question. Next question is also about the thyroid and also has to do with lab testing and what you should get, what information you should get from your doctor. So this question says, I just looked at my last set of thyroid labs after being told by my doctor that everything was normal. My TSH was actually at 4.5 and I know that you guys recommend it being below 2.5. Why would my doctor have not mentioned this to me?
Yeah. What an excellent question. So what's really interesting is that there's a lot of controversy around like what the TSH should be normally. There has been some expert opinion suggesting that the true upper limit of TSH is only 2.5 or 3 in healthy individuals without thyroid disease and who are not pregnant. So they have this diagnosis called subclinical hypothyroid. And what that means is that you have a normal T4, a normal T3, but your TSH is borderline high. So anywhere between that like 4 and 5 level, or maybe even higher. Because of this controversy, there's a lot of doctors that do it very differently. And if it's not above their reference range with the lab that they're using, then they're going to consider it normal, especially if you're not pregnant, right? So there's different reference ranges when you're pregnant. They are going to use a 2.5 cutoff if you're pregnant. But if you're not, even if you're actively trying to conceive, they're not going to say anything. Now, there's again, back to the experts that are like, well, this should actually be different. Now there's even more experts that are basically saying, if you're trying to conceive or you're dealing with infertility, then the elevations in TSH should be the markers that you should be using to treat. It should be going off of the first trimester specific TSH reference ranges. So that's, again, that 2.5. So right. That is conventional medical knowledge. However, it's fairly new, and a lot of just general primary care docs aren't up to speed on that, but your gynecologist should be, and all reproductive endocrinologists should definitely be up on that.
Yeah, they definitely should be. And it's, you know, it's frustrating because a lot of times you don't get your physical results from your physician when blood work is ordered in. So this is a really good reason to advocate to actually be able to see your results. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those reasons, because you don't necessarily need to have a medical degree to understand or to be able to find information on what functional ranges are and whether or not you fall within that. And I think that that's a good opportunity to advocate for yourself a little bit and talk to your physician about what might be optimal for this particular period of your life. Like Dr. Haley said, you know, if we're looking at a reference range that goes up to 4.5 or 5, not trying to conceive, maybe we should narrow that range a little bit. And I just want to comment that, you know, the functional range for me, like what I aim for in my practice, just because of how people feel, is between 1 and 2. I think people feel their best between a TSH of 1 and 2. So if it's possible to get it into that range, that would be awesome. But certainly under 2.5 is going to be the goal if you're going to be actively trying to conceive.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Hopefully that didn't open up a whole can of worms.
So we do have a whole episode on thyroid, which I believe we delved quite a bit deeper into all of this information. And I'm going to go off the top of my head, so I should have prepared for this beforehand to know which episode I could direct you to for all of this information. And I'm going to go with 39. Yes, 39, low thyroid, how to find and fix the root cause. So if you guys are looking for a super in-depth discussion on thyroid and have not caught that episode yet, you can check there.
Awesome. Okay, we're going to move on to question 4. So question 4, the label on my prenatals just says folate. How do I tell if this is actually the right form of folate?
Oh, this is super annoying. I feel like companies are doing this nowadays because there is so much buzz around getting an active form of folate and having that be optimal, since not everybody knows like what their MTHFR status is. They don't know whether their body can convert the synthetic form of folate into active folate. There's evidence now showing that regardless of whether or not you have a problem with conversion of inactive synthetic folic acid to active folate, that it's still better to provide the active form. And so companies that don't want to change their formulation because active forms of folate are more expensive, they're putting things like just folate on the label instead of specifying like folinic acid or L5-MTHF or methylfolate. So they're putting that on there, I think, intentionally to market themselves as better than they really are. And so a lot of companies, and this question specifically came from somebody, I answered this, I believe, on Instagram. And this question came specifically from someone whose label said folate, and then in parentheses, in really tiny print, it said as folic acid.
So
sometimes you'll see that where the big dark print says folate, and it makes you think that folate, oh yeah, I'm getting the active form. And then in parentheses or in smaller print, or like maybe even an asterisk, and then below the label, it'll specify that it's folic acid. So this is a pain if the company doesn't explicitly say what type of folate they're using. That's really annoying. I would contact the company if you really like the prenatal that you're taking and you really want to know whether or not they're using folic acid or an active form of folate, which are going to be the ones I mentioned, the L5-MTHF, methylfolate, L5-methyltetrahydrofolate. It'll be somewhere in that range. There's different ways of denoting it on a label. So if you really want to know, you can contact the company and find out what they're using. A lot of the brands that we personally recommend to clients and patients include those forms. We don't recommend any prenatal vitamins that have synthetic folic acid in it. So if you're curious about that, you can check out the How to Choose the Best Prenatal Supplements course. We go over kind of how to evaluate the labels of your current supplements, like what your supplement should include, what form is best, what to look for on the label. And then we have brand recommendations in there for which brands actually meet all of the specific requirements that we lay out. So the link to the course, which is totally free to sign up for, it's a free mini course. It takes about an hour or so to complete if you go straight through. And that link is in the episode description. So hopefully that helps. Like I said, this is kind of a sneaky marketing thing that companies are doing these days. So you do have to be a little bit more discerning if you get a nondescript label like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Agree with Krista. I actually have nothing to add.
All right.
Okay. Number five, is it possible to overdo it on B vitamins? I get this question a lot.
Yeah. So yes and no, I guess is the answer to that question. Technically no. And the reason for that is that B vitamins are water soluble, meaning that if you overconsume them or you get more in the system than your body can use, they just get excreted in the urine. Mm-hmm. We just talked
bright about yellow urine.
Yeah. Bright yellow urine that might smell a little funky too. But the thing about that, though, is that with synthetic forms of B vitamins, we are starting to see research that if we overconsume synthetic forms of B vitamins like folic acid and cyanocobalamin for B12, it is possible that some of those things might not be able to be metabolized and excreted as efficiently, especially if we're consuming large amounts of them every day. So in the case of B12 and folic acid, we can get those in fortified food. Most foods, like processed foods, are fortifying with folic acid by law if it's a processed grain product and we're in the United States, which we are. There is mandatory fortification of processed flour products. And so if you're getting a whole bunch of folic acid from food and you're also getting a whole bunch of folic acid from supplements, that could potentially cause issues and build up what's called unmetabolized folate in the blood. The other thing to note is that some people are sensitive to the activated forms of these B vitamins. So you can overdo it on methylated B vitamins. So you can go overboard on methylated B12 as well as the methylfolate that we were just talking about. Some people have symptoms when they take too much of those methylated nutrients. So some of the things that you might experience if you were sensitive to methyl donors would be like headaches, irritability, like maybe some muscle pain, or just kind of unusual symptoms, like you just feel odd or keyed up or maybe anxious when you take some of these things. It could be that you're overdoing it on methyl donors that you don't need.
Yeah, I agree. If you want to actually see on paper if you're sensitive to these particular B vitamins, there is that's tested for in the MaxGen test that we've talked about before, which is testing your genetic SNPs, and it will tell you if you're sensitive to methylfolate or methyl B12. And so I would suggest this, well, I suggest it for anybody trying to conceive because I really like this test and it gives you a lot of information. However, if you found that you take methylated B vitamins and you get a headache, or if you just feel like really jittery or nauseous or
irritable,
all sorts of symptoms, or like muscle pain, joint pain, things like that, then it's likely you might be sensitive. You may also have an MTHFR mutation, especially the homozygous mutations where you have both of those SNPs. Sometimes you have to really ease your way into taking more vitamins because your body has been depleted for so long. This happened to me, and probably to Kristen too, is that your body is just depleted for so long. When you jump right into the deep end, like you don't feel well, you don't know how to swim yet, right? You got to start in the shallow end. You got to just barely kind of dip your toes in there, and then just slowly increase over time and get your body used to these kind of methylated Bs. But to really figure all that out, you can head to tinyfeet.co and go to the blog, and there's a blog right there that's called Max Gen testing or something. It has something
about genetics. It's what's the last one that's on there. We've been so busy with the podcast that there has been no active blogging on there for a while. So I think it's the last article from.
So if you want to learn about that, and then also Dr. Ben Lynch, we have a podcast with him too that talks all about genetic testing as well. And I think he's coming out with his own SNP testing.
Yeah, it's like a month away from being released. I'm kind of excited about it because I, you know, MaxGen is amazing and I kind of want to compare the report side by side to see what's going to be the best option going forward. And he talks about this also in his book called Dirty Genes. And I think it's important to note with his work that he actually, like, if you look at all of your genetic SNPs, MTHFR is not the priority out of like the order of operations in which he would address these or suggest that a client or patient address them. And the reason for that is because all of these genetic pathways are very intertwined. And if you try to start upregulating one without addressing some of these other ones, you can end up with symptoms or an apparent sensitivity to these methylated B vitamins. So that's a great point, Dr. Haley. Thank you.
I'm a living example of it.
I honestly did not feel great. Like, I started on the Seeking Health prenatal, which is one of the top prenatals that we recommend in our course and to clients and patients. I started on that several years ago, like way before my days of, you know, fertility knowledge. And I did have to titrate that supplement pretty carefully because I had a lot of issues going on back then that I didn't know about. And it did, I did overdo it in the very beginning and had to go slow and was able over the course of a couple of months to take the full dose and not have any problems and actually felt good. But that first few weeks or about a month or so, it was kind of hard.
Yeah. Okay. So hopefully that helps. You guys, the next question is it okay to drink coffee while trying to conceive? I want to give it up, but I'm having a hard time. Is there any suggestions on what I can do to replace coffee?
Oh, okay. Another question with a lot of controversy around it. So the general answer to the question, is it okay to drink coffee while trying to conceive? Yes and no. Again, it depends. Some people are really sensitive to caffeine. They don't do well with it. Do you feel really wired or jittery after you drink coffee, or you don't sleep well on the same day that you're drinking coffee? It's probably just not a good idea for you, whether you're trying to conceive or not. In terms of drinking coffee during the preconception period for people that don't feel like they have an issue with caffeine, I think the research at this point says that 200 milligrams a day or less is probably okay. However, we have had other experts on the podcast that argue that the research around caffeine and miscarriage risk is pretty convincing. Dr. Jordan Robertson is one of the ones that we have talked to that really feels like coffee should just not be in the game, particularly if you have a history of or are concerned about the possibility of miscarriage.
Yeah.
What do you have to add to that, Dr.?
Yeah, it was pretty surprising to me when she said that.
However, she's like a hard no on coffee and alcohol.
We live in the Northwest, and so, you know, it's coffee nation over here, and we find all sorts of reasons to try to be able to drink it. But yeah, no, I agree with Kristen. I agree with the 200 milligrams thing, or, you know, one cup of coffee. However, there are some really cool alternatives, especially with all these great companies coming out to be able to replace coffee and have it still be really delicious and just avoid the caffeine content in coffee. Another thing I didn't mention too with coffee is, you know, making sure that you're getting organic, that you're trying to get more of like a neutral acidity or more alkaline type of coffee, because it is really acidic and the pesticides that they use for these coffee beans are pretty high. So, you know, it also depends on what kind of coffee you're drinking as well. So some alternatives, roasted dandelion root tea can be really pleasant and taste similar to coffee, sort of, but, you know, put some tea in it and maybe a little bit of whatever milk, you know, alternative milk or whatever that you like to use. And it could be really nice. And then one of my patients gave me something that's trending a lot is this cocoa blends or something like that. Anyway, you can make like a cocoa drink in the morning, which has a lot less caffeine in it, but it can still be really delicious and tastes really good, and it's really high in antioxidants. And so I actually don't remember the name of it, so I'm sorry, guys, but I think you could just kind of Google like cocoa superfood drinks or something, and you'll find a good alternative.
And then did you mention like tea, green tea, matcha? Those have less caffeine.
Yeah, matcha's great.
There is still caffeine in there, but it is higher in antioxidants. So it can be a good alternative. And then one thing I really wanted to mention, I just recommended this to a client the other day that was having actually the very client that asked this question about what she could replace coffee with.
What'd you say, Kristen?
I found this company, and I'm pretty sure that they're accessible in places outside the Northwest. I don't think they're local here. The company's called Four Sigmatic, and the focus of their company is actually like mushrooms.
The shaga mushroom.
I hesitate to say medicinal mushrooms because that sounds like has a weird context, like magic mushrooms. No, we're not talking about magic mushrooms. We're talking about things like chaga and reishi and cordyceps and lion's mane and some of these that have really great adaptogenic properties. And so they can actually kind of be stimulating without providing any caffeine. And they have the company has a bunch of different blends. So they have one that my husband loves. He drinks every morning and it's their mushroom coffee. So it is coffee. And I believe it's organic coffee, but it only has like 50 milligrams of caffeine because they combine it with these medicinal mushrooms. And so it still kind of has the taste of coffee with a little added earthiness, much less caffeine. And then the adaptogenic properties.
Ooh, I love that. That's a really good idea.
Of these mushrooms. And so that was what I recommended to this particular client that was struggling really hard with giving up caffeine. She was trying to replace it with tea, but it just wasn't quite enough. And we're working through some other issues with her too that are specific around like energy and things. And so I was like, you know, in the interim, if you're miserable giving up caffeine, don't put your body through that kind of stress and just drag through your entire day. Let's see if we can get it as low as possible and then support you with other methods.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Good.
Hopefully that's plenty of information. I guess this is a hard one because it's not a concrete answer. There are a lot of things to consider. And what Dr. Haley said about the quality with coffee, there's also concerns about whether it's organic or not, possibly being a food that is a bit higher in natural mold toxicity.
Yeah.
So there's lots of cans of worms with coffee. Hopefully we at least let you know that it's not a hard and fast yes or no either direction. There are a few things to consider. And if you are concerned about your coffee consumption or how that might be affecting you, talk to somebody who can give you more concrete guidance based on your specific situation.
I wanted to say one last thing because you mentioned matcha and I'm going to bring this up again because it's really important, but some people have genetic SNPs where they cannot tolerate matcha. And so if you find that that's it, like if you get muscle aches, joint pain, headache, fatigue, which it's not supposed to give you fatigue. So that's really weird. Then you are probably one that just doesn't tolerate matcha. You might want to just move on to like the medicinal mushrooms or something.
Yeah. Well, it's good that there are so many options. I don't think we mentioned kombucha, and I mean, kombucha is great as like kind of an occasional thing. I probably wouldn't recommend it daily just because it does have some sugar in it and it still is based on tea. It has less caffeine as a fermented tea than typical green or black tea, but it's also an option for an occasional pick me up.
Yeah.
Mostly for the afternoon. I feel like it's maybe weird to drink fermented tea in the morning, but perhaps other people feel differently. I don't know.
It's not my preference, but everybody has their own preference.
It's for me, it's like if I happen to be dragging in the afternoon, I'll pick up a kombucha. Okay. So I think we've beat the caffeine thing to death. So let's move on to the next question, which is what supplements should men take to prepare for pregnancy if they're healthy and there's no reason to suspect any issues with semen quality?
Oh dear. Men.
They're so easy though.
I know. With men, there's so many things you can do. The thing that gets all like the physicians and the nutritionists and everybody is super excited about male fertility is that we have so much research to show how good, how really direct like A equals B, like zinc equals good motility, vitamin C equals, you know, sperm count. Like it's really quite clear. How much these supplements and a good diet can help with healthy sperm. So first of all, what's healthy, right? So we really want to make sure that they really are eating like a Mediterranean style diet, really limiting alcohol, caffeine intake, that they're getting fatty fish in there, or taking a good fish oil if they hate fish. And so all that is going to really help with sperm quality. So to answer the question, I would say a good start obviously would be a good multivitamin with methylated folate and B12. My favorite multi for men's health is the Pure One, or Pure Encapsulations One, so O-N-E. It's just one a day, and usually if they're trying to conceive, I would recommend they take two, so one in the morning, one at night. And that has a good amount of zinc in it, and it has the type of folate and B vitamins in it as well, plus some extra CoQ10, which is really good for sperm health as well.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of other antioxidants in there too, like some lycopene and some other things, good amount of selenium. That's such a great one because it has so many things in it for just being one capsule a day, which is awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's the one that Matt takes, my husband, and I'm trying to get him to take two a day, but if he takes one a day, we're
then you're happy.
Real good.
Yeah. Well, and that particular supplement is in the male fertility category in our Full Script store. So you can find it there along with a couple of the other things that we recommend. What I would recommend adding to a good multivitamin is a good high quality fish oil and maybe an extra drop of vitamin D as well. I think the Pure Encapsulations One, if they're taking one a day, it has 2000 IU in it. That might be sufficient. Depends on whether or not vitamin D levels are already sufficient for guys. If not, if they're taking two capsules a day, they probably don't need a separate vitamin D supplement. If they're taking one and they're deficient, they probably might need a little extra vitamin D. But the multivitamin and the fish oil are kind of like, that's like the core protocol.
And the last thing I really like adding is more vitamin C. So like 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C. It's really easy. You can get like chewable vitamin C. I mean, just kind of, you know, guys like to think that they're really protecting themselves during the winter time too with vitamin C, which they are. So I think that's been shown in research to be really helpful for sperm and something pretty easy to convince them to take. So
agreed. And if you're listening to this and you're wondering, what if my guy is not quite on the healthy side, or we do know that there are some issues with sperm quality, we do have a couple of episodes on male fertility specifically back in the teens and early 20s. I think that was 19 and 20 are the two episodes that we had about male fertility. One is actually an interview with our partners about preconception health, which was kind of fun to bring them on the podcast. So if you're curious about hearing from our other halves, that's fun. But I think 19 was the episode that we did that was more in depth about male fertility and how to support that if there is an issue. And we also had an episode with Lauren Manneker on the podcast. We just talked about her book a few weeks ago in our favorite preconception books. She wrote Fueling Male Fertility, and that's a great resource that talks a little bit more about diet supplements.
I think we'll also probably try to get a male physician on. There's somebody I have in mind that we'll get on the podcast to to continue the conversation around male fertility, because it really is important.
Yeah. Oh, and we have, maybe I shouldn't spill the beans on this yet, but we are looking at sharing with you guys a resource for semen quality testing for semen analysis.
Oh, right.
And we are hoping to have the founder of that company here on the podcast to share a little bit more about some of the options around testing, because things are evolving and it's becoming easier and something that guys can actually do at home instead of having, and still get a quality fertility clinic quality analysis done without actually having to go and do it, or without having to go and talk to a physician about the possibility that their semen quality might be off. And that's just one of the reasons I think men decide not to go to get that done sooner, is because it's a pain and it just might be a little embarrassing or a little invasive to them. So we will talk more about that on the podcast soon and hopefully have an episode with the founder of that particular company. And what is our next question? Where are we at here?
Eight.
Oh, this is a fun one. And we actually did chat about this briefly before this episode, because we were both like, yeah, this is a toughie. So what would the underlying cause of night sweats be, and what can we do about them?
All right. So with night sweats, there's the first thing that we think about, and that's basically like perimenopause, right? Like your estrogen's dropping, and you're having some type of like hot flash at night, and that can cause night sweats. And so usually, you know, for women, especially around, you know, the early 40s, late 40s, that's going to be related to estrogen. However, there are other causes of night sweats that can be much more, let's say,
much I don't less scary. Say,
well, the perimenopause isn't scary. I mean, that's just is what it is. But
well, for women trying to conceive, it might be.
Yeah. Well, yes, exactly. If you're trying to conceive, that is scary, and you'll definitely want to, you know, test your hormones and kind of see if that's actually the case. However, night sweats can also be connected to like liver, like a sluggish liver, that it's a way of your body just trying to like flush things out at night. If something is really bothering your system. And so that's the next thing I think of with night sweats is liver. And then on the super scary end would be more like cancer, is a symptom of night sweats. However, you know, let's think about the first things first, right?
What's more likely to be the cause in a, you know, preconception.
In a young,
yeah,
reproductive aged woman. Yeah, cancer would definitely be more of like the zebra, but it is something that most, I would say almost all physicians are going to have on the back of their back burner as like a potential diagnosis, but that's not going to be the first place they go.
Yeah. So I would say if you're having night sweats, pay attention to when they're happening in your cycle. So probably not as concerning if they're happening right before your period, for instance, because, you know, if estrogen is dropping off really sharply before you start your cycle, then that is going to be, you know, and it's only happening for like a day or two or whatever around your period. That's likely just an estrogen. The cause of that is probably estrogen. If you're having it, you know, mid-cycle or you're having it another time, it could be related to even cortisol levels. I mean, chronic stress and the liver are very intertwined. That all has an impact on, you know, blood sugar and how well your liver functions and is able to rid itself of toxins. So cortisol.
Yeah, low blood sugar could also.
Yeah, low blood sugar. And that would be like, when your blood sugar, this happens at night a lot with people who wake up. So like if you're waking up between like 1 and 3 a.m. every night and you think you're waking up because you have to pee, but you're also really sweaty or whatever, that's a sign that your blood sugar is dropping overnight, meaning that it's not stable throughout the day, which is mostly a dietary consideration, but could also be related to your stress levels. And so if that blood sugar drops off, your cortisol actually rises to help bring your blood sugar up. And that's a physiological stress response that's supposed to be really helpful for us in times of stress, but can be really disruptive to sleep and potentially contribute to something like night sweats. So cortisol, liver, and estrogen are the primary considerations, but to know exactly what's happening, I would give a little bit more information to your practitioner and have them investigate what might be the most likely cause. Just make sure that, you know, if you're working with somebody like us, that you are also, you know, keeping your primary care physician in the loop as well on testing and investigation that you're doing, just so that there's always the ability to rule out something zebra-like, like cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Hopefully that helps a little bit. That one's an interesting issue to be seeing in younger women, but there are answers. Next question. Is it normal to not get your period back right away after having an IUD removed? And when should you be concerned if you have not seen your cycle return after IUD removal?
Yeah, such a good question. So it is kind of normal. First, it depends on what kind of IUD you have. If you have the non-hormonal IUD, the copper IUD or Paragard, when it's removed, you should get your period back right away. If you ever lost it in the first place, that's also concerning because you really shouldn't, it's non-hormonal. So you should always have kind of a regular period with that kind of IUD. The hormonal birth controls like the Skyla, Kylena, Lyletta, those are going to usually make your period go away, right? Especially the higher dose ones like the Mirena and things like that. So your period's going to thin, and then pretty much you don't have a period. And when you take it out, your body needs to readjust to not having that exogenous hormone there in your uterus. And it can take up to 3 months to get your period back. So when you should be concerned is if after 90 days, you no longer, or you still don't have your period, then you want to do a workup for amenorrhea or you know, not having a cycle. This was really interesting. I took an IUD out for one of my patients and she was about at that 3 month mark and she came back in to see me. And, you know, I did a pelvic exam. Actually, I think we were doing her annual. We did her annual exam. And then during her annual exam, I actually saw that she had her period, which was brilliant. It was like incredible timing that I was like, oh, guess what? Like you're good now. So it's, and she was pretty concerned, you know? So I was like, oh, no concern. You're
good.
You're fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think whoever asked this question originally, this might've come up in our Facebook group, but, I think also the question follow on to that was, what can I do to get it back faster? And if you have been on a hormonal IUD and lost your period and your body is still trying to get rid of some of those hormones, that main indication is going to be your liver. You know, is your liver weighed down a little bit and actually able to process and remove those hormones from the body? So if you're not actively trying to conceive, focusing a little bit on detoxification, or, you know, if you are actively trying to conceive and you want to include one of the gentle detox methods that we talked about at the beginning, something like castor oil packs could be really helpful. Maybe, you know, some herbal support that has like a little bit of milk thistle in it. Of course, with supplements, always talk to your practitioner. You know, don't just go out and get something to decide that you're going to detox your body. But, you know, exercise, movement, good diet, low sugar, healthy fats, those things are going to be, and plenty of quality protein is important with detox as well. So, oh, and brassica family veggies, lots of your cruciferous vegetables, like your broccoli and kale, cabbage, cauliflower, eating those a ton can help, especially with the estrogen component of detoxification.
Yeah. Okay. Last but not least, our last question is, should I have my metal fillings removed before I try to get pregnant?
Oh man, that's a podcast episode right there. And in fact, that's a really good point because I am planning to have somebody with us this year on the podcast. I'm hoping that we'll be able to get him scheduled. His name is Dr. Chris Shade, and he founded a company called Quicksilver Scientific. Quicksilver, standing obviously for mercury, since that is that's what we used to call mercury. And so metal fillings or amalgam fillings are 50% mercury. And so the primary concern that we have with metal fillings is the ability of mercury to actually outgas from the filling and absorb into the bloodstream. And so whether or not this is going to be a huge concern depends on a lot of different factors. Number one, how many fillings do you have? What teeth are they in? So how big are the fillings themselves? How long have you had them? Have they like degraded over time? Are they in good shape? Are they looking like maybe they need to be replaced? Those are all considerations that might give us more information about how much circulating inorganic mercury you might be having in your body. And some other considerations are, what else is your body dealing with in terms of toxic burden? Are you showing signs of issues with heavy metals, which unfortunately can look like almost anything under the sun? So any chronic symptoms that are just not going away, like you're doing all the things, diet and lifestyle, supporting with supplements, and you're still seeing a lot of chronic symptoms, that might be a time where if you have metal fillings, you might want to consider the possibility that mercury exposure could be contributing to your chronic issues. And then mercury is a concerning element to have in the body during preconception and pregnancy. And you know, if we're getting a continuous exposure that's going into the bloodstream, mercury does cross the placenta. We do know that. And because babies are so small and so vulnerable, the concentration of mercury that ends up in baby's bloodstream actually is higher than the concentration of mercury that's in mom. I think it's about 1.5 times. And the half-life of mercury in the body, so how long it takes for half of the amount that's in there to be removed, is fairly long. You know, we're looking at like 70 days. So whether or not you remove your fillings before you decide to get pregnant is a very individualized choice and one that you should make with a practitioner. It's not as simple as just pop your fillings out and get pregnant. They need to be removed properly by a dentist who is trained in safe mercury removal. And this is actually something that I talk about in the Fertile in 5 course that we have, and I give some resources about how to find a biological dentist. But essentially, a biological dentist is probably going to be the safest place to start looking for a mercury safe trained practitioner to have these removed for you if you decide you want to do that. There's also testing available to see how much impact mercury might be having on your system. And that testing is available through Quiksilver Scientific. And I would love to have Dr. Shade come on and talk about that test because it's very unique and it's very different than other testing methods that are available on the market. There's also a whole blood metals test that tests for other things besides mercury that's pretty cool as well. And then in terms of what does the picture look like if you do decide to have them removed, it's going to be a detox process. You know, you do need to focus on active removal. And there are a lot of unsafe ways to detox metals. I think chelation is IV chelation is one of the top recommendations in natural medicine that does need to be done by a licensed practitioner who's very experienced in chelation. But Dr. Shade's approach is different. He focuses on upregulating the body's internal method of removing metals instead of doing something like chelation, which can pull a large amount of mercury from the tissues into the bloodstream all at once and potentially cause a ton of symptoms, be very dangerous, and redistribute metals to places that you don't want them to go. So you pull them out of one tissue and they end up in another one, and maybe that actually causes more issues than where you had it in the first place. So there's a lot of things to consider with metals. If you're not prepared to remove them and go through a minimum of 6 months of focused detoxification, don't take them out before pregnancy. If you're not willing to go through that time period, you don't want to like take them out and then immediately get pregnant because that could be risky for the baby. Sometimes, you know, the best thing to do is just to support your body as much as possible while you still have them in and kind of hope for the best. Mercury is a tough subject. Heavy metals are a tough subject. Mm-hmm. What do you have to add to that, Dr. Haley?
Oh my gosh, I have nothing to add. I haven't actually delved into, mercury fillings and even other teeth issues as far as prepping for fertility or infertility mm-hmm. with my own patients personally. However, it is something that is on my intake form and it is something that I'll refer out to if I feel like it's a significant issue that we need to address. For sure. Yeah. But no, I agree with everything that you're saying. And I don't want people to be really freaked out. But at the same time, if they have suspicion that this is an issue for them, then don't disregard it as like, oh, they're safe and they're fine. And, because there's a lot of information out there that shows that they're not. And it could definitely be something that's just burdening your system and taking all of its attention and leaving your reproductive system in the dust. And that's maybe part of the reason why you're having trouble conceiving. So it's definitely something to look into.
Yeah, very, very individualized. And like I said, how much you're being exposed to and how much that's affecting you depends on how many you have, which teeth they're in, what condition they're in, and what your detoxification system is doing. Because if you're mm-hmm. handling those pretty well and it's not creating a significant issue, it might not be worth it. It's not free to remove your mercury fillings.
Oh my gosh, far from it.
Typically not done with your regular dentist, and mm-hmm. it's not usually an insurance covered procedure if there's nothing technically wrong with the fillings themselves. And so this is, and then the detoxification process is not short and it's not cheap. And so sometimes the best option is to leave them in, support the body as much as you can, not actively push detoxification, but just try to support the body's natural elimination as much as you possibly can. And, you know, just do whatever you need to do to support baby when they're born to make sure that you can optimize, you know, their health as much as possible. This is just one potential exposure of many. So if this is something that you can't control, focus on all the other things that you can control. That would be my advice.
Good advice. All right. We made it through.
We did all 10 questions that we had. So these are really fun. This is the first one of these that we've done. And I thought that this was really awesome and fun. And I would love to do more of these. But what that means is that we need your questions. So write to me on Instagram at tinyfeet.co. If you're part of the private Facebook group, share your questions there. You can also email info@tinyfeet.co or kristen@tinyfeet.co. And I would be happy to take your questions there. And of course, I'm not going to wait for a podcast episode to respond to you. So I will give you my take on the answers to these questions. And then we will take those anonymously, like we did today, and share them on the podcast for other people who can benefit from these answers. So we would love to have your questions. So share away. And we would love to do another one of these next time we have a free space without an interview. All right. Have a great week, guys.